Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the eighth in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive through questions posed to the participants an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. With us today to discuss constitutional issues, we have Mark Masteller, Michelle Church, Mike Bileski. And I want to thank you all for coming because this is a very difficult topic and one that I believe has a lot of impact on the way we live today and the way our country was constructed. So with that, I want to get to the first question. And as I'm asking these questions, what I'm going to do is take particular excerpts from the Constitution that relate to the question I'm about to ask. So the first excerpt is from Article 1, Section 8, where it says, Congress shall have the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. Now, naturalization is about immigration. And given the fact that we've had all these executive orders from Obama and now Trump about naturalization and immigration, is it fair to say that Congress has been sort of not following their constitutional duty because they haven't really given us any kind of rule on naturalization, immigration, since the Reagan years? So is it fair to say that constitutionally, Congress needs to step up to the plate a little bit more?
I would say, yeah. I think they need to step up to the plate on a lot of things, frankly. But I think they have failed in coming up with some kind of protocol that allows for faster immigration for people who want to come to the United States. I don't think we should have just anybody coming in at any time, perhaps, without any kind of overview. But I also don't think it should take years. And I think that in countries where there is war and famine and things like that, I think America needs to become more like Lady Liberty and
welcoming.
Yeah.
I think also that the, inactivity in Congress has led presidents like Obama to feel like something needs to be done to address the challenges that are happening. And therefore, the only, without a Congress willing to act, and we've had a situation for quite some time now where the Congress hasn't been able to act on many things at all, the executive is kind of forced to do something because there's an issue, there's a problem, there's things that have to be solved, and executive action is the only option available to them without congressional review.
So we have 11 million illegal immigrants in this country, and Congress hasn't really done anything to address that. So Obama and then now Trump is doing something about it. What do you think about that, Mike?
Well, I have two levels of response. One that looks back to the original settlers who came to push aside those people who lived here in what we call the United States of America. And I'm wondering what the immigration rules were at that time when people left to – this is prior to the Revolution and the Constitution being formed, et cetera. And in even the early days of the United States as it was formed, I reached that far back because I remember somewhere a phrase that says liberty and justice for all. And I didn't take that to mean it was restricted. It meant if you were in any way going to be within the purview of this country, whether you had arrived as an immigrant or you were a citizen defined variously, you would still be afforded this kind of idea of liberty and justice.
And actually, that's a good segue for the 14th Amendment when we get to the 14th Amendment.
Right, right. Yeah. So my sense is I think people have responded to the situations of the moment. And what we have, anyone looking at immigration history would note that, oh, yeah, we've done this, and then we tweaked that, and we've gone over here. So I look at the moment today and say it's another form of tweaking, but it still hasn't come up to be a sustainable approach, and that's difficult. I think that witness what we've done over the years.
So you're giving Congress a pass on it.
I'm saying this is a very difficult issue to deal with, and as a result, I don't give them a pass. I think it's something that needs to be dealt with, absolutely. But in the present time, given the present constitution of the Congress, they have not been able to focus on that. So they've dealt with it as a peripheral, surface level, little change here, a little change there. And that's what's caused people so much angst, because trying to say, okay, you're saying this today, tomorrow what is it going to be?
And right. Yeah. Immigration has just sort of become just another campaign slogan, another bullet to put on somebody's campaign flyer, either I'm for immigration or against immigration. And I don't think that the general public maybe has even thought, you know, to that degree at all. It's just it's one of those hot button words that people respond to viscerally for whatever reasons. And a lot of times it really is based on a level of ignorance on either the situation or the current situation, whatever, or the people involved. So,
okay, we're moving on to the next topic. Now, this topic has to deal with two particular excerpts from the Constitution. The first one is from Article 1, Section 8, which we just read, but it says, Congress shall have the power to declare war. Okay, and the second one is coming from Article 2, and that states that the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States. So, Congress has the power to declare war. The president shall be commander-in-chief. And the question is, does a surprise preemptive nuclear strike on North Korea constitute a declaration of war requiring congressional approval, or does the commander-in-chief have the constitutional authority to nuke North Korea without Congress?
Wow, okay.
Nobody wanted to grab that.
Yeah, that's pretty uncomfortable.
Well, the way I look at that is that, excuse me, we've seen many situations in the last 40 years where the executive has made a decision and gone forward. And we've seen several situations where Congress has said, wait a minute, we never did declare war. And that hasn't stopped us from doing anything. So, you know, if I look at it right now, I mean, this is why I would be very nervous with Donald Trump in office, because of that same situation where often the executive ends up acting and they can bicker back and forth whether they're going, whether it's legal or not, but we've seen it happen since Vietnam War, at least, where the executive makes a decision and goes ahead and does it. And, you know, George Bush in the 60s as well. So it's happening. And then Congress can say, wait a minute, you know, we need to declare war, or we did not declare war. This is an unjustified war. But it hasn't changed anything at all.
But isn't,
and I don't see Congress necessarily saying, wait a minute, let's turn this money spigot off because we don't think this is legal.
Well, when we talk about a lot of the things that have been occurring militarily across the globe involving United States forces, what they've done is use that war resolutions of from post 9/11, which basically Congress gave the executive, the commander in chief, the authority to go after terrorism wherever it is.
Right. Okay.
This is different. This a nuclear strike on North Korea would be one where we would eliminate a country. It would be. I don't know if you could call it war. That's what I'm asking.
I'm sure the North Koreans would call it war.
So I have a question, which shows my, you know, I'm like the perfect person to have here because I'm ignorant on all of this stuff. When the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, was Congress advised?
We already declared war 1941. December 8th, we declared war.
So once war was declared, it was like throw whatever you got at it.
So to that point, Paul, was that the last time that Congress declared war?
Yeah, I believe
it's so because Korea was a police action.
Right, it was not.
Right.
You're right.
Effort, et cetera. Yeah. Vietnam was never declared as a war.
That's right.
Iraq, Afghanistan. Pick
Gulf
your
War.
Poison.
How about the Persian Gulf War?
It was not
did
a war.
Did we not give President Bush, H.W. Bush, the authorization to attack Iraq?
I don't know that.
I believe it was.
I believe it was authorized by Congress.
That may have been the one time. And that one was interesting. If so, let's go on the premise that it was. Because Persian Gulf ended. In other words, there was action ending World War II, World War I. We have these, I hate to use the term neat, but packaged events that occurred. But the open-ended aspect to go after terrorism, which had already been in place. I mean, terrorism was still something you would confront and deal with in a variety of different ways. Many agencies did that. But now we have the layered on that I think speaks to the point you're making about the nuclear deterrence and the question about a first strike capability has to do with the speed with which things develop. We go back to the Guns of August, First World War. That seemed that got moving, and the argument was it just got out of control and kept moving. This happens in split seconds. Someone makes the decision. You go to attack, you can fire multiple missiles, et cetera, but it's not going to be restricted, even if you say we're just targeting North Korea.
Yeah.
I think the point it is made is that South Korea is very close. We are very close. Dumping that much weaponry in that one place changes the world, not just North Korea. And I think there are a number of people that what I hear and see is a number of military people, most recently military person saying, well, we're not really going to just say yes, sir, if he says fire. That's kind of an interesting thing. So I think we're in what would be called never before experienced time. This is a different time because of the technology, et cetera, because of who's at play, because we have someone in North Korea and perhaps in the White House who are twins separated at birth. I don't know.
So do you think it's constitutionally proper to restrict Trump's access to first strike capability?
I would say yes. I mean, looking at Article 8, first, I mean, if you just look at the money aspects, it states to raise and support armies, this is one of the things that Congress gets to do. Congress shall have the power to blah, 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 to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years, and to provide and maintain a Navy. So it would seem that if you're going to approve a war, you would have to approve funding of that war prior to pushing whatever buttons you're going to push.
And for me, it's another indication of how it was very different when they were writing this than it is now. I mean, on any subject you want to talk about, but this is one that comes up. You know, now, just today, we have evidence that North Korea launched a ballistic missile, right? So at some point, do we say, hey, their capability of having a ballistic missile means we're in danger and we're going to have a first strike versus, hey, we've got plenty of ballistic missiles. You know, why are we the only ones that are allowed to supposedly have these kinds of weapons? That's pretty arrogant, in my opinion, on our part.
The only nuclear bombs that were dropped on civilian populations were dropped by Americans
by us
on Japan.
Yeah. So a quick little check showed that it was in World War II time frame. It was the last time the U.S. Congress declared war.
Well, he's the only,
nice to have
he's the only
that,
one with a
yeah,
computer
that
right there.
In 1942.
If only Congress
Romania.
Had access to Google.
That was the last one after 1941.
So the Gulf War was not.
The first declaration of war was with Great Britain in 1812, and many of us understand that. That's when it first happened. And basically, Congress has only declared war 11 times, but the last was at the beginning of World War II. So we are now 70 years beyond that time. No one in Congress today is even close to remembering any of that. Mm-hmm. And I would submit that we are on new ground. This is a new place. And because of the proliferation of weaponry, the speed with which we can respond, I'm going to argue that.
Would you say that the new place you're talking about is post-constitutional?
I'm saying it is requiring a very clear review, because the basic argument here is between strict constitutionalists who say, you know, this is to be taken literally. An interpretation of the Constitution in the modern day, paralleling discussions about the Bible. And I think that's where we are today. It seems to me, and I'll fall on to say there's a base foundation of intent, but the interpretation of the Constitution, which is we can witness what the Supreme Court has done and others, absolutely is required. This isn't Thomas Jefferson's world.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We are bridging the gap. Alaskans discussing one of the many issues that divides us politically. We are here to seek solutions to those issues through examination and dialogue. Today we are talking about the Constitution and how it is affecting our society some 230 some years after, yeah, I think it's 230, maybe 240. Years after its ratification. Okay. Another excerpt I want to read deals with Donald Trump and one of the ways that he is running a presidency, and that has to do with his compensation. Article 2, Section 1 says, the president shall at stated times receive for his services a compensation, which shall be neither increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected. And he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or any of them. Now, Trump tends to spend his working weekends, I guess it's one-third of his time away from the White House, at his golf resort properties, which requires his White House staff, cabinet secretaries and their staffs, Secret Service details, to get rooms at those hotels where they're staying. These rooms and meals are paid for by the Treasury via per diem into Trump's business holdings. Is this a violation of the Emoluments Clause?
Yes.
Clearly.
Mike, everybody else seems to have.
Well, not only that, not only is it clear, but there all the other business situations that he refused to give up on, like other presidents have done, which means he can still be making money on things that have to do with him and enrich him during his time in office. So clearly, I think, you know, that whole emoluments thing, he clearly is violating that.
Well, I'd once again bring up a predecessor, Thomas Jefferson, who, when he left Washington after being president, traveled back home, Monticello, because people put some money together to be make it possible for him to make the trip. He did not leave office as a wealthy person, and in fact, when he died, he was not a wealthy person. And I just have this sense that what we have done today, and it's not just talking about the present president, any of the presidents who can easily get a seven-figure contract for a book or whatever, they may not do a lot to make money off being president while they're president, but after the fact, they do.
Well, the key is while he's
president. Yeah, while he's
exactly.
President.
Yes. And so that this seems to be a break in a very clear fashion with predecessors, whether you go all the way back to Jefferson or you want to just go back to Obama or the Bushes or whatever. Yeah. So I'm in agreement with you.
Okay. I'm going to read another excerpt. Section 4 of Article 2. The president, the vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Okay. Is coordination with Russia and the Trump campaign about issues related to the 2016 presidential election constitute treason?
Well, I'll just take a stab at that and say that that's what Mr. Mueller is working on, and I'm going to let him do his job because that's a pretty big subject. And, you know, there's an awful lot there, but there was just something I saw or heard on the radio today about how other countries have had this issue happen to them, and they've been prepared for Russia trying to influence an election. And
France did a pretty good job last time. They have done things to counteract
that. Mm-hmm. And so we shouldn't have been surprised by it, but I'm curious to see what comes out of it. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that the person who the Russians most wanted to win the election won the election.
I think, you know, I remember as I was looking through this, I Googled the word treason because I thought, what is treason?
That's my next question. What is treason?
Yeah. What rises to the level of treason? And can't remember exactly what it said, but basically you had to do something that put the United States at great risk. So I think personally that Donald Trump has done that. I think that is the point that will be argued, though, is whether or not he did so for personal gain. Does that rise to the level of treason? You know, I don't know, but I think that's what Mueller is working on right now. What was the backstory, if he can find out what the backstory is, because that really is what will define whether it was a treasonous act or just a very selfish.
Well, the question assumes that there was coordination between the Trump campaign, which we don't know for sure.
Contrary view here. Timing is important in many of these things, I would think. So talk to me a little bit more about the problem with the Trump campaign working with Putin and the Russians or the French or whoever to support his campaign.
Well, that's
prior to being elected.
That's the question.
Is there a problem?
The coordination with any foreign power of a domestic campaign, presidential campaign, does that rise to the level of treason? That is the question. So are you saying that you don't think it does?
I think there's a difference. I think it's a difference in something that we tend to forget. Or if you've occupied a position of any sort, president, member of any government body, et cetera, when you're not and when you are, it's different. And so I'm not at the moment saying I don't think he did a bad thing or maybe even anything that could be prosecutable. But I think the difference is once he became president, what continued on, and there's a gray area, that in-between zone, when you've been elected, but you're not yet president officially, because you can't order things, you can't make things happen.
The transition period.
Right. So I think we have three zones, whatever led up to the
election. Did you ask whether did you mean coordination, say, with Russia before his campaign or before his election?
Before he was elected.
Because to me, it's a clear issue if they're coordinating with any foreign power during the campaign. Because as an example, the one thing that, of course, this is just what's in the news media, somebody approaching Trump's staff and saying, we're with Russia and we have dirt on Hillary Clinton. And if that's during a campaign, I consider that a huge problem. Absolutely.
But
now, if it was his business.
Doing a treasonous act is not limited to the president of the United States.
That's right.
I mean, that's why Snowden is hiding in Russia right now, is because he is considered to have done a treasonous act by releasing information.
Is the only example of treason espionage, or are there other examples of treason beyond espionage?
Well, I think that's the question, and Google treason. What is the definition of treason?
So still, the question, I threw it out there, I know.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is there something specifically criminal in behavior that is prosecutable about collusion prior to the election? Or are we really talking about people lying under oath, which is a really bad thing to do? So if you have had talks with the Russians,
prosecutable,
yeah, but it may be bad in our view. You shouldn't do it, et cetera. It shows you in a bad light. It shows that you're really not with the country, et cetera. But I'm just raising the question about there being these three periods of time: whatever's done before, whatever's done in transition, and once you're in office, another set of references. The thing that I understand that people are getting caught on, and this has happened before, is perjuring themselves in an official sworn testimony.
That's what got Clinton.
Yeah, is we'll get
perjury.
We've got lots of people. So I'm more interested in the figuring out, getting out what actually happened. So whether General Flynn, for example, is going to work a deal, and he's going to come out and they're going to say, okay, here's what happened. And yeah, I lied about it, but under my deal, I'm home free because I'm turning state's evidence or whatever. Okay, so that's what I'm looking at. Now, whether all of that pointing to the time before the election is going to be a problem that you will call a traitorous act under the law, just because you're running and you happen to take something from someone outside the country or inside the country as support, I don't know. I leave it to the lawyers to decide that. But I see a difference in all of that. And I see the Constitution is not saying, before you become president, you can't do this, that, or the other thing. My understanding.
Well, Article 3, Section 3 says, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court.
So it only works for war? Is that what we're hearing?
I think
giving comfort to enemies.
That's the problem with this document. Not that there's a problem with the Constitution. The problem
is there's plenty of problems with it.
Well, the problem is in the fact that really the people of this country, myself included, really don't understand what this says. And again, it goes back to what was the intent of the original authors. And you got to give them like some major cred on what they wrote. Basically, what they were trying to do is they were trying to write a document that was broad enough with their understanding of what would protect the country and so that we wouldn't be led by despots, basically. I mean, it seems to me that was their goal throughout this whole thing. So there's lots of, as you mentioned, the Bible. I mean, you can take snippets of any of this and plaster it up there, and people are like, oh, that's what that says. And they think that that's the entirety of what that says. And it really isn't. And it's very confusing. And I think that that's why we have a special prosecutor and we have all of Congress kind of looking around like nobody in this country knows what's going on.
Well, I would agree with a lot of that, except that I think we have to also look at this document as framed by, I mean, who framed it? You know, who was not at the table? Because there's plenty in there about, you know, that enslaved people and counted women differently, et cetera. So, but understanding that's the time they were in, I would agree with you that they were trying to write a document that hopefully could work to make sure we didn't have despots, tyranny, maybe. I would agree with that. But it also needed amendment. You know, number one, the Bill of Rights right away was a bunch of amendments,
the
right?
First ten amendments.
And then we had to amend it again for all sorts of other things, and that's where we need to keep amending based on newer technology or new what we know now. But I can go back and say, wait a minute, it was just a bunch of old white guys making rules for old white guys, and they really didn't care that much about the rest of us, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But the documents framed well to help, you know, think about something different than a monarchy.
Mm-hmm. So in a word, this was in part aspirational, meaning that knowing, I think it's arguable that the framers knew there would be changes, probably didn't anticipate all the ones that would occur by any means, but they knew there would be changes. And I think your point is extremely well taken. This is an amendable document. The Constitution didn't have a clause that said, and that's it, no changes, nope,
right.
no more.
In fact, they were very specific about the
fact
that they were going to have amendments. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer. Bridging the Gap is the name of our panel discussion. We are Alaskans discussing one of the many issues dividing us politically. Today we're talking about the Constitution. Okay, can someone...
And, you know, just one thing, Paul, before leave that last subject is that it's not just the president or somebody who can commit treason, as Michelle pointed out. You know, that's why Snowden's worried. So getting to Mike's point of, you know, if there's these three different transitional periods, I'm not so sure I see why that matters. If I'm committing treason by colluding with a foreign body, I can do it before I even decide to run for election. But definitely, in my opinion, if I've made this decision to run for president of the United States, I have to be ethically above reproach.
But I would say legally as well.
So here's the difference, perhaps, whether it's Snowden or in some cases other candidates for the presidency who were sitting senators, et cetera, occupied an official position. Mr. Trump was a businessman. He had no official position. To me, that makes a difference. It makes a huge difference if you're an attorney general or a senator or a governor and you're running for office and you go to a foreign power. I think there's an interesting.
So are you saying that, if you're a government official, you can commit treason, but if you're a private citizen, you can't?
No, just the opposite. I'm saying that if you're a government employee with all of the guidelines that are associated with that, I think there's a difference between that and being a private citizen who's running for office. I'm just throwing that out to
you. So it's treason with a little t or a capital T, basically.
Let's go back to one other point, one other very important point. Think about it here. We are not at war. So all of that stuff about doing things during a war, we sort of take off the table. Now, people would argue, well, we're in this war against terrorism, et cetera. Yeah, but we're not in a declared state of war.
And we haven't been for 70-some years, but what happened to the Cold War?
Well, that was
And we still don't really trust the Russians, as far as I remember.
So. But we still, and that's the other point. Today we like them, tomorrow we don't. I mean, we trade with, have ambassadors, we talk with them, we're back and forth. We've got this little dance going on that's happening, et cetera. And we say, oh, my. So enemy, friend, which is it? Because if we the last 30 years or so of relationships with the Soviet Union and Russia have been up and down.
Yeah.
We've had at the early, even the early stages of Putin's reign. Yeah. Do business with them, et cetera. All kinds of things happening. Investment, this, that, and the other thing. As time has gone on, it's a different story. But, you know,
if we can declare Russia a friend, then it wouldn't be treason colluding them. But if Russia is declared an enemy, colluding with them would then be a treasonous act.
So we need a frenemy article change
in the Constitution.
Let's hold that thought for a
frenemy.
Moment.
The frenemy article.
Go for it. This is KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio, 89.7 on your radio dial in Palmer and Wasilla, 89.5 in the Sutton area, and 91.5 in the Glacier View. This is Bridging the Gap. We're discussing the Constitution, one of the many issues that divides us politically. I have a question. What is the difference, could someone explain to me, between a bribe, which is an impeachable offense, and a campaign contribution?
Well, I can say that a campaign contribution happens to help you get elected. A bribe happens after you're elected and somebody has asked you to do something because they gave you a campaign contribution.
Okay, what if you're elected and then it's after you're elected and you're still soliciting campaign contributions? How does that fit in with your definition?
Well, I think that's one of the many problems with our system right now is that our elected officials spend more time trying to get reelected than they do trying to actually do the business that they were elected to do. Obviously, people are going to contribute to your campaign because they agree with your philosophies and your points of view, and so you're likely to vote in ways that please them. That doesn't make it a bribe.
What makes it a bribe?
To me, it makes it a bribe when it's something that is not in the benefit of the community. And
I could say the entire Republican agenda is not in the benefit.
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah. I don't know.
What do you think about that, Mark? What makes it a bribe?
Well, I mean, I don't know the definitions of those things enough, except that, you know, a bribe is clearly to do a specific thing to benefit a specific entity. But again, I'm not so sure I can tell you the difference between a campaign contribution and that, except that if campaign contributions were kept small enough, then they are simply to help people get elected to do a job. When they get to be huge, they're like bribes.
Right. Yes.
And this is one of my problems with the whole system right now is that, you know, getting to the Citizens United decision and all
that. In a minute. First of all, I'm here, Mike's what's the difference between a bribe? Is it the size of the amount of money?
It has nothing to do with the size of the amount of money. It has all to do with two things. One, the intention on the person who is the briber, and the response of the bribee. I learned about this when I had little kids. I want you to do something, okay? So I'll give you some money. I'll bribe you to do it. I'll give you this money and you'll do it, okay? Now, we loosely use that term. There's another little thing that goes in amongst that, though. And that's, once again, back to this question of, can I bribe a kid or can I only bribe someone who is in a position of authority to do something for me? okay, yeah, different than that person would do for anyone.
Right.
And I think that's where we take the loose use of the term bribe and we pin it down legally to say, and that's why it's so difficult to prove, you know, you want the videotape in the hotel room to say, you gave me money and I'm going to do this for you and I'm a government person, either elected mm-hmm. official or whatever, and I'm taking this money to do that, and it's for that money that I'm doing it, not because your cause is just, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, that's
so if the message is delivered in a different way outside the hotel room where the surveillance is occurring and there's still money transferred into the campaign coffers, then it's okay then.
Yeah, if you do not make explicit, you can talk about all the nuance you want. Someone comes by, we throw this around a lot. We said, oh, okay, we've reviewed that person's history of contributions. We can say the big money people from this group has given it to him, and then we can go on down and say, well, look at all of the positions that person has taken. They seem to support that industry, which has given all the money. Well, that's cool. That's still cool because you still, if that's just the way it is. You can't say on the one hand that you have really changed this person with that money, although it suggests that that's the case. And that's why we don't have very many convictions for bribery, because there is a law and there is a willingness to say you're innocent until proven guilty, so we have to get it pinned down to make sure that we have it.
And I think it's difficult to prove intent on either side. But that's why there aren't these convictions that you talk of, but there's evidence, say, for things like on the federal level, how the general public feels about something like climate change versus how people are voting, and then there's a huge amount of evidence of groups donating money to fight climate science, you know. So
sure,
we can see clearly that some people are voting against the public interest, and whether, I guess we could quibble whether we want to call that a bribe or not. But
well,
they're clearly not voting for the public interest.
So really the question, which is so hard, is what is in the mind and heart of the
right.
person?
Yeah.
Are they making
yeah.
calculatingly a decision to take the money and do this even though they believe something else?
Right.
Or do they believe it and the money is just frosting on the cake?
And I think there's a clear issue as somebody – I think there's a clear problem when – Any human, if they're given this large amount of support, their natural inclination is to help that person who gave them the large amount of support.
You're
I think that's a
sure.
inherent problem in our
yeah.
system. Yeah.
Mark, you did a lot of research on Citizens United. Want to tell us what you learned?
Well, I don't know if I'd say I did a lot of research. I mean, I've been in.
Well, you told me.
I've been concerned about Citizens United for quite some time. Because all the evidence is that it opened the floodgates to more and more money going, basically money that's untraceable. So it's not a transparent support system going to certain candidates. And the gist of it is that super wealthy people can now almost with people with unlimited resources can have a huge amount of sway in any election. And take that a couple steps further and say, well, that affects the Supreme Court. If the Koch brothers say in 2016 they're going to spend $889 million on this election, none of us could even come close to matching that. But what does that help do? That helps get somebody else elected who then appoints a judge who can make a Supreme Court decision. So it has impacts all the way along. And there's lots and lots of data about this, but the fact is, well, one fact is, in 2014, I think, the 100 top donors, and this is just of what we know they donated, there's hundreds of millions of dollars of what was what we call dark money not known about, but the top 100 people donated as much as the bottom 4.5 million people who donated $200 or less. Which means we have an oligarchy, and I'm concerned about that.
I want to quote a amendment that never made it into the Constitution. It is, so it doesn't have a number, but it's the Equal Rights Amendment. It was not ratified. Section 1 of the Equal Rights Amendment says, the equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And that needed 38 states to ratify it. Only managed to get 35 states to ratify it. And my question to the panel is, why? What is so wrong about that, that it didn't become an amendment to the Constitution?
I think that for me, and again, I consider myself, you know, not a, certainly a brilliant scholar by any stretch, but, you know, I know how to read. And I, as an American woman, did not know that that was not a ratified amendment to the Constitution. And I think that that is the case for a lot of people, because women have the right to vote. And therefore, we feel at certain level that, okay, there has been this legal equality given, even though women still don't make as much money. You know, there's, you know, all of the sexual harassment that's been coming out
lately
certainly shows that women are not treated equally. So I actually was very surprised and kind of ashamed that I did not know that that was not a ratified amendment.
Never made it, yeah.
Although I posted that on Facebook. I was like, what? And comments that I got was, oh, there's a few states now that like it's getting closer. So I don't
actually
know.
There was a deadline. It wasn't
It was in the 80s, right? So they would have to reopen. And you know, my son who has worked for the legislature, I was like, so son who knows these things and who actually went to college studying these things, should Hillary Clinton or another woman somewhere down the line win the seat of president, does the entire Constitution have to be amended in order to have the S/HE added in order for that woman to have the power of the presidency?
Ooh. That's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, some people would argue that unless we have that amendment, we can't let that woman do anything.
Well, his comment was that it would apply, that they would just say the presidency. However, I personally disagreed with that, because when in the Constitution they discuss the Senate, when they discuss the House representatives, they use the pronoun they or them. They don't give it a sexual whatever.
A gender preference.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So, but the president is always referred to as he. So does that not require the entire Constitution be reopened or an amendment
question.
Be done?
Well, I'm not sure that in my sense, the changes that have been wrought talk about more in the line of speaking about men. In a plural sense of men and women, and then you can be very specific and talk about men and women, but I also have a sense that will not be a problem.
To me, I mean, that was sort of the first thing that I thought. I thought, well, hey, wait a second here.
Yeah.
Now, that it was just interesting to me that they only address the president as he and the Congress as a they or a them, as a collective.
Where does it say there's a time limit on amendments? Do you know?
It was just that amendment.
They must have set that in the...
They set that for the ratification had to occur. And actually, they extended
it. But is that true for
1979,
any amendment?
For the ratification process, yeah. There was a certain amount of time. I think they gave it 7 years. And then they
is
had
that
to extend it another 3 years.
Is the 7 years in the Constitution?
I think I saw some...
For amendments?
Yeah. I think
for
so.
For the ratification.
Is that in the Constitution?
I believe so.
Okay.
I'm not. Yeah. What I think it is the Congress shall have the power to direct it. And
they set it open forevermore.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to read another excerpt here. This is from Article 2, Section 1. Each state shall appoint in such manner as legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in Congress. Okay. So because Alaska has one congressman and two senators, we have three electors. All right. And then the 12th Amendment came along. It was after the 1800 election, which was a huge mess. Thomas Jefferson became president. Mm-hmm. Aaron Burr actually got more votes starting out with. And then we had that big mess with John Adams and everything. So they put the 12th Amendment together, which basically said that we're going to have the president be voted for and the vice president be voted for. So that basically is what established the political parties in America. But nowhere could I find where it said that the states where the electors, where the president won the popular vote, no matter how slim the margin, would get all the electors voting for that person.
Oh, no. It's in there.
Okay.
The states determine the way in which electors are chosen.
Well, the legislatures, yes.
So Article 2, Section 1, it talks about how the votes will get split up, and it says the states get to decide. And typically that –
Well, it says here, it says this: each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislatures thereof may direct a number of electors.
Right.
Okay. So they're the ones picking the electors, but do they then decide that it's a winner take all? I guess they have that power.
So as it was amended in 1804, mm-hmm. the states have the jurisdiction to – decide how the electoral votes are divvied up. That's why Maine and Nebraska
are different.
So they've made a state level decision on how they're going to divide their electoral votes.
And the other 48 states have decided it's winner take all.
Winner take all.
And actually got to include D.C. in there too. They got three votes.
Right.
Okay. Well, that takes care of that.
Well,
and what I'd like to know is why other states haven't gone the same way as Maine and Nebraska, because I like that idea. Personally, I like to get rid of the Electoral College, but if we can't get rid of the Electoral College, why don't we go to some, my vote would count more if part of my electoral vote people had to vote the way the state went. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So because you only have to win half plus one in order to get all.
Right. Mm-hmm. That would tend to change.
So it disenfranchises a huge number.
Okay, we only have a minute left, so I want to leave the constitutional topic for a second and ask that because we are a year in the election, since the election of Donald Trump as president, do you feel that we have been bridging the gap here between the two polarized sections, the Trump supporters and the anti-Trump, or has there been any progress made in bridging the gap?
I don't think so at all. I don't see it at all.
I think it's gotten worse, as a matter of fact, as far as the gap. And I also think that, that this president has the lowest popularity ever, and usually there's some sort of a grace period, and he didn't get that. But the number of people who support him strongly is, if nothing else, declining. But the gap's definitely there and getting worse in lots of ways.
Mike, you and I had a conversation one time where you said to me that the thing that we need to try to do is to keep asking questions. Tell me more. Tell me more about why you're upset or what is.
Well, I think is that asking the questions is the important point. And contrary to the other two panelists, I really think that what has begun to happen is a hardening of core groups, both, if you will, Trump supporters and those who oppose him, which suggests to me you have a growing in-between body. I think given what has been suggested about the lack of popularity, all of the issues that are stressing people, whether it's tax revision, you name it, health care, that you have a much larger group of people in the middle who are looking and saying, now, wait a moment, this isn't working. And I think what we have to do is keep asking questions that are not directing accusations at the other side, if you will. So I think the gap, interestingly enough, is being filled with more people who are still milling around, and they'll become focused as we get closer to the next election.
2018.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen is that the extremes are not going to be driving the boat. Mm. I think everyone is going to realize, we've got a larger number of people in the middle, and those are the people that are going to make the difference. I think that's already beginning to show, and I think in part it will be a reflection of what happens in a place like Alabama, the senatorial race that's coming up in December. Mm. I think there are a lot of people there that are not strictly Judge Moore's supporters or Jones supporters. That's a microcosm of the larger. Well, they have a third option now. The retired Marine colonel who's thrown himself in as a write-in vote. I would speak to that and say that's just the example of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Here's someone who looked down and said, I don't want to go this way, I don't want to go that way. I'm going to offer myself up and grab you people in the middle. Now, whether he's at all successful or not, that's another thing.
Or who that benefits.
Yeah.
Thank you, panelists. It's been a wonderful conversation. Mike, Michelle, Mark, we appreciate it. This is Bridging the Gap. Bye now.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.